From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Lionel Hampton tells us how he became the first jazz vibraphonist and later broke the color barrier playing with the Benny Goodman Quartet. Also, we meet one of Brazil's most popular singer-songwriters, Caetano Veloso. In the 60s, he led the music movement known as Tropicalismo. It put a rock beat into bossa nova. It also got Veloso thrown in jail by the dictatorship. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the new movie, My Left Foot, about Christy Brown, an Irish painter and writer with cerebral palsy. It stars Daniel Day-Lewis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Leading Democratic senators today warned of a possible suspension of U.S. military aid to El Salvador following the murder of six Jesuit priests yesterday in San Salvador. Christopher Dodd, chairman of the Western Hemisphere Subcommittee of the Foreign Relations Committee, said there's been no conclusive evidence of who killed the priests and two university employees, but Dodd said strong circumstantial evidence points to right-wing death squads operating under the protection of the Salvadoran security forces. The United Nations Secretary General expressed shock today at yesterday's killings and called for an immediate halt to the fighting in El Salvador. A UN special human rights investigator also expressed concern over the number and seriousness of rights violations so far this year in El Salvador. In the country today, left-wing rebels have pulled out of several of the areas they've held in the capital for the last 6 days. They still have strong positions in the north of the city of San Salvador. Tom Gibb has more.
While the neighborhood of Mexicanos in the north of the city is still firmly under rebel control, elsewhere the guerrillas have withdrawn after massive government bombardment with tanks, artillery, helicopters, and planes. The guerrillas left several dead, but the huge majority of fighters escaped. When the army advanced, they'd simply disappeared. It's not clear whether they've completely left the city or are regrouping. The rebels are withdrawing after holding off the U.S.-backed army for 6 days. The offensive has been an embarrassment both to the government and the United States, who for the last 5 years have been saying the guerrillas are a fading force. For National Public Radio, this is Tom Gibb in San Salvador.
West Berlin expects huge crowds of visitors from the eastern half of the city. Officials expect the biggest influx since the wall opened a week ago. NPR's Robert Siegel reports.
Last weekend, about 2 million people came from the east to Berlin alone, and there's no telling how many will come back and how many will come over for the first time to look around and spend the 100 marks they receive from the West German government as greeting money. That's about $55. Last weekend's crush brought mass transit to a standstill. The city hopes to avoid that this time by adding extra trains and buses, keeping some subways open all night, and by asking East Germans to leave their cars at home. The rest of West Germany can expect big crowds, too. In the east, traffic is already backed up for 50 miles at some border crossings. West Berlin officials expect 10 more openings in the Berlin Wall in the next few days, but there's no indication that Berlin's famed Brandenburg Gate will be open to east-west traffic anytime soon. In West Berlin, this is Robert Siegel.
Budapest Radio reported today that Romania has sealed its border with reformist Hungary. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 17 points to close at 26.52.66, advances ahead of decline 7-6. This is NPR News. The Senate cut off any potential filibuster and refused to delay a showdown decision today as it moves toward passage of a big pay raise for members of Congress and other top government officials. The Senate moved swiftly after the two leaders, Democrat George Mitchell and Republican Robert Dole, urged colleagues to approve a pay raise to match the one passed by the House yesterday, but the bill still faces a series of amendments. Today, the Senate rejected President Bush's nominee for the post of Agriculture Assistant Secretary. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
James Kaysen is a high-ranking official at the Interior Department. He was nominated to be the Assistant Secretary of Agriculture for Natural Resources. Kaysen's nomination met with strong opposition from environmentalists. They said he was biased in favor of private development. One senator called Kaysen a James Watt clone, referring to the former Interior Secretary. The Agriculture Committee voted 12-7 to send Kaysen's nomination to the floor of the Senate, but Kaysen's opponents predicted he would be defeated there by a 20-vote margin. Senate leaders today agreed not to let his nomination come up for a vote and to send Kaysen's name back to the White House with a request that someone else be selected for the post. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A Senate panel today called for an end to federal tinkering and the formation of an independent tribal government and governments following an investigation uncovering massive corruption and mismanagement in the handling of Indian affairs. The special Senate investigating committee recommended a new federalism for American Indians. Panel Chairman Dennis DeConcini said tribes should be allowed to withdraw voluntarily from current federal programs and negotiate with the president to form their own government. Under the committee's plan, the federal funds that would have been funneled to Native Americans through government management programs would now be sent directly to the tribes. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 17 points. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the musician who brought the vibraphone into jazz and became one of the world's best-known band leaders, Lionel Hampton. That's Hampton's 1942 recording of his theme, Flying Home. The record foreshadows the development of rhythm and blues. Before Hampton formed his own band, he played with the Benny Goodman Quartet. The quartet's records are still considered some of the finest small group sessions in jazz history. The quartet also made history as the first integrated group. The 81-year-old Hampton still has a big band and tours America and Europe. He also has a new autobiography that tells the story of how he became a drummer, vibraphonist, bandleader, housing magnate, and Republican fundraiser. The book is called Hamp. When Lionel Hampton was a child, he moved with his family from Birmingham, Alabama, up to Chicago.
My grandmother had the family, and she had my uncle, her son, to go to Chicago to find a place where our family could live, because she was taking us up on the pension that my grandfather had left, because he was a fireman on the railroad, and he got a good pension. And we also had tickets that we could travel on the railroad through his pension. And so my uncle went to Chicago, and he stayed a little long time, and my grandmother finally heard from him, and they found out that he had got an apartment, and he had a good job, and he had sent some money along with the money we had, because he was working for Al Capone in his syndicate, in the whiskey syndicate, making bootleg whiskey.
Well, you said that Al Capone was the savior of black musicians.
Yeah, he was. Any place that he controlled, he owned, or any of his associates owned, he would insist that they hire black musicians. And Earl Hines and Louis Armstrong and Jimmy Noon and several others that I haven't called their names yet, they used to work in these places. And they fed their families, and their pursuit of happiness and their living was dependent on these jobs. And we all thank Mr. Capone today that our family was able to survive from the work that he gave us in his place's establishment.
Where did you live when you first moved to Chicago during Prohibition? Were you living near the stills that your Uncle Richard had?
Yeah, we're living in the next building, yes. Because they gave him the building, you know. Oh, it was a beautiful flat building, you understand?
Capone gave him the building?
Yes, the syndicate where it was. And then the next door, he owned that building too, and that's where the family lived at, you understand? And we had a really good living. We was good livers in that times, because we had money enough to have the necessary things that we needed, you know, clothes and food and things like that.
Well, in fact, it sounds like you were pretty well-to-do at the time. You described the silk shirts that you used to wear to school, and a lot of the other students in the school were pretty poor and belonged to gangs and had knives and were very tough, and you didn't feel really up for that.
No. Well, I did. I tell you, my uncle, he and I was very close together, and when he would buy a silk shirt, he would get one to fit me. And when he'd get a hard shopping and marked suit, he would get one to fit me. So I was his buddy, and I ran with him, and I admired him, too.
So you were exposed to a lot of great musicians at the speakeasies. Were you exposed to much of the crime part of the syndicate?
No, just only the good time part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle used to have, in Chicago those days, used to have the Blue Monday parties. And that Blue Monday party is when they all used to get together, all the good timers, and they would have different piano players to come in and play for them, which Jerry Roll Moden, I heard him play at a young age, because he came to my uncle's house and played the piano, and he had some wonderful musicians, you know, at that time. A boy by the name of Teddy Rutherford, he was a great piano player, and they had some piano players by the name of Toothpick, long, tall guy. Boy, he really could play the blues on the piano. And they had another guy that could play by the name of Rabbit. He could play the blues, you understand? And the guys that my uncle picked out to play, well, he would pay them, too. They wouldn't have to come. They get all the whiskey they want to drink, but they would get an honorarium, too.
What was it like when Prohibition ended?
Well, I was in music then. My aunt had moved to California, and my grandmother gave me permission to go out there with her because I had been promised a job with a group called Reb Spikes and his Rebels or something like that. Because Les Hike, a guy that I had played with around Chicago, when I was playing in Chicago Defender Newspaper Boys Band, I was a youngster, but older musicians liked to play with me because I could keep good time on drums. I really could had a solid beat. So Les Hike moved to California, and he got this job in the Les Hike and Rev Spikes Band, and they needed a drummer, and he told them about me. And boy, I went out there and played, and from there I went to the Paul Harvard Quality Serenaders. These are the name of these bands in those days. But this was supposed to be the elite band of that area.
Well, I'll tell you, I want to play something you recorded with Paul Howard's Quality Serenaders, but I'm going to go right to a part where you're doing some scat singing, because I especially like your singing on this. And this was recorded in 1929. At the time, you were playing drums, a little bit of piano with the band, and doing some singing. This is Lionel Hampton. I guess Lionel Hampton is recorded in 1929. That's just terrific. I love it. It's very funny in your book. You describe how you were imitating Armstrong at the time and how you try almost to get laryngitis to sound more like him.
Well, you know, that Louis was my idol, I guess, as was all the youngsters in that area. Louis was our mentor by way of hearing about on the records, you understand?
You were actually with Louis Armstrong the first time you played the vibraphone.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you first see a vibraphone, and how did you start playing it?
Right in the studio that day that I was with Louis Armstrong. That's the first time I saw the vibe.
So you were recording together. This was in 1930.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what made you go up to it and actually start playing it?
Because he asked me what the instrument was, and I told him, I said, I heard about this instrument. So Louis asked me, he said, what is an instrument? And I was playing it to him. He said, can you play it? And I'm a brazen young kid. I never played it before. I said, sure, because I had played xylophones in Chicago when I was in the Chicago Fender Band, Newspaper Boys Band. And in the concert band, I played the xylophones and the timpanis. And the marching band, I played the snare drum. So I haven't played some of the solos out to hear, practiced some of the solos out to hear Louis Armstrong play on recordings, and also Coleman Hawkins and different good jazz musicians like that. And so Louis asked me to play some on them, on the vibes, and I pull them out in the middle of the floor. In fact, about he said, pull them out in the middle of the floor here and play something. And I played one of his solos, note for note, that I'd taken off the record. And boy, he was so enthused, he said, come on, play on the record here. We're going to record. And the number we was going to record was a number that Hubie Blake had just wrote, and he called Memories of You. And Louis was going to record it. And so I played all through Memories of You, and that's the first time jazz ever been played on the vibraphones.
So it was through Armstrong that you, it was when you were with Armstrong that you first started playing vibraphone.
Mm-hmm. I played with Louis for 9 months, and I didn't have no vibes, but I had a little set of orchestra bells that had the same keyboard, and Louis used to have me to play behind him when he sang. I would do the fill-ins. And then I met my late wife, Gladys, and she helped me to get a set of vibes, because she liked the vibes, you know what I'm saying? She was telling me, say, you play drums all right, but play those vibes.
And you knew that you wanted to give up drums for this instrument?
No, I didn't want to give up drums. I wanted to play drums, too, which I do now. I play a lot of drums in my band now. I play drums and vibes and play piano, too.
So when you were playing vibraphones, the first jazz musician to play vibraphones, were musicians anxious or reluctant to play with a vibist?
Well, they was all anxious to play the vibes, but the vibes cost so much money they had to save up the money to get the vibes, and the vibes cost $1,000, $1,500, $2,000, like that. And they liked the sound. The sound was a sound of electronics, which we have today. So many.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is jazz vibraphonist and band leader Lionel Hampton, who's just written a new autobiography called Hamp. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Lionel Hampton is my guest. It was in the mid-1930s that John Hammond heard you play vibraphones and told Benny Goodman that he should come and hear you. So he came and heard you. I think you jammed. And then he invited you to come back east and join the band. Now, you thought he was inviting you to join his orchestra. But in fact, he was inviting you to join his smaller group, which when you joined became a quartet. Why did he want you in the small group but not in the orchestra?
This place I was playing at, the Paradise Nightclub, and I had my band down there playing. Well, lo and behold, Benny Goodman came to California with his orchestra playing at a place called Palomar Ballroom, and John Hammond had been in my place, heard me play, and brought Benny down. And lo and behold, I was playing one night, and there I heard this guy playing clarinet next to me, and I said, gee, this is great. And it was Benny Goodman. He had brought Gene Krupa with him and brought Teddy Wilson. Teddy Wilson used to go with Benny at that time, but he would play intermission piano. He wasn't playing with the band. And it was uncalled for that black and white mixed together in those days. They didn't. In fact, about blacks and whites, socially economically, didn't gel together in those days. And so Benny got on the stand and played with me, and he liked it so well, we jammed for about 2 hours. So he said, come on, let's record this out to RCA studio. And we did. We went out there, and we made a record. And the record got so popular. We made Moon Glow and Dinah. It got so popular, and it could run all awards all over the country. And everybody started to saying, well, this is great. This is a new find here. And so that's the reason why Benny wanted me to come in. He wanted to keep the quartet going, because the quartet had achieved a high point in the music business that I didn't think Benny was looking for. And then there was a chance that the mix to have white and black play together. I don't think Benny was looking at that so much, but he realized later that he was being Abraham Lincoln for the music business.
Mm-hmm. Let me play something that you recorded with Benny Goodman as part of the Benny Goodman Quartet. And this is Sweet Georgia Brown as recorded in 1938. I guess Lionel Hampton featured on Vibes. This Benny Goodman Quartet with you and Teddy Wilson at the piano, it's the group that broke the color barrier in jazz. And you said that there was actually fear that there'd be race riots when you first started performing. Did anything like that ever happen? What was the most negative response you got when the quartet started playing?
Well, I'll tell you, we played in Dallas, Texas, and they had the big Centennial down there. At the big bowl, and they had a lot of attractions that come there to try to fill the place, and none of them could. So somebody told him, said, we ought to get Benny Goodman's group. So Benny told him what he had, two black boys playing in his organization, and they said, well, okay, come on. And they went down and played. It was played for 10 days. It was a place held about 20,000 people, and Benny kept the place packed every night and probably that many was outside waiting to get in. But on the fairground, they had white drinking water and black drinking water. So Teddy and I, you know, we was from the north and we didn't pay much attention to where we should drink the water. So we used to drink out of white drinking water. And so policemen reprimanded us about doing this. And so Teddy didn't want to play down there no more. So Benny finally got the chief of police and some of the leaders of the town telling him that there wasn't nothing going to happen, that we was respectable guys, respectable gentlemen, and that wasn't nobody going to bother us and that we could drink out any water we wanted. And that's the only thing that ever happened.
You left the Goodman Quartet in 1940,
mm-hmm.
and formed your own orchestra.
Yeah.
You say in your book that you've always wanted to carry on the tradition of showmanship and clowning in black performing. Why has that been important to you?
Well, clowning, I never was clowning. The music moved me, and if I feel like I want to dance, I feel like I want to jump up and shout, well, I do it. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were the first one used to go out in the audience and do the tailgate parade, you know, and involve the audience and do what our playing. And but we didn't do it just because we had something fixed, you know, to do some clowning like that. It was only spiritually. The spirit hit us and we moved.
When you were leading your own band and touring the country, when there was still segregation and you were performing in the South, was it different for you? Did you end up staying in different places? And what was it like to be leading a band in the segregated South then?
Yeah, well, it didn't happen that long. It happened about one time around. It, you know, I had a mixed band. I took the first mixed band in the South. And the people just hooray for it. I mean, the whites used to used to have to be up in the balcony, and they would come down from the balcony and come down the main floor and mingle with the blacks, you understand? In some places they have ropes in the middle of the dance hall, and they would have whites on one side and blacks on the other side, and somebody would cut the rope, and everybody would mix together again. And you understand, the people just cheered, I mean, black and whites alike, and we had no trouble at all.
While your wife, Gladys, was alive, she served as your business manager.
Mm-hmm.
And you describe how she would always tell producers to not give the money to you, but to give it to her.
Yes.
What was your problem with money?
No, that was the best thing in life I ever did, because she invested and put it in the right place. And when she passed on, she told me, said, you be able to look in some of the literature or the books or look in the wills, and you'll find out that you'll be protected for life.
What was your problem with money? Why did she take it and not let you have it? She'd give you an allowance.
Yeah, I like to have a good time. You know, give it away. You know, the guy come and give you a hard luck story. Yeah, here it is, man. Take it, understand? You know, that was my makeup.
She and you had a reputation among musicians, I think, for being a little stingy with money when it came to paying the salaries of the orchestra members. Well, you even say in your book that there was a period during World War II when the band members were getting $38 a night, and Gladys was buying $1,000 war bonds each week.
Well, that was her business, you understand? I knew later that I seen the benefits of it. Good benefits.
Mm-hmm. You've also in your life been very active in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly for the Republican Party. How did you become politically involved?
Well, I was in Los Angeles, California, and when President Nixon was a congressman in Los Angeles, he was used to come and campaign on amongst the blacks, because he knew that he had a good sea of people there that never was in politics before, that he can convert them, and he did. You know, out of 22,000 blacks on South Central Avenue, he converted about 12,000 to be Republicans. And I used to go and play with him in his parties and also his rallies. And we got to be good friends, you know, right up until he got to be vice president. From vice president, he got to be president. We was always connected with each other.
So you helped him register a lot of black voters before the election?
Yeah, in Los Angeles, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What's your tour schedule now? You're still very active musically.
Oh, tour. I just been to Europe 4 times.
Already?
Every time I go 4 weeks at a time, yeah. And going again in December 27, I opened up at the Marien Hotel in Paris for 2 weeks.
Do you think you'll ever retire from music?
No. I'll stay out there in this place as long as I can. I love it. This is my life. I don't know anything better I like than to play music and can play. I think I'm right at the top peak now playing.
Okay, I thank you so much for talking with us.
All right, thank you.
Lionel Hampton has been my guest, and he has a new autobiography, which is called Hamp, and it's published by Warner Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And next time, my guests will be the drummer and bass player from the band Talking Heads, Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth. They also have their own band, the Tom Tom Club. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Brazilian singer-songwriter Caetano Veloso tells us about the music movement he created in the 60s, known as Tropicalismo. His music led to his imprisonment and temporary exile. He's very popular in Brazil and has a new record in the U.S. Also, critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews the new movie My Left Foot, starring English actor Daniel Day-Lewis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Meia lua inteira, supapo, na cara do fraco, estrangeiro gozador, coca de coqueiro baixo, quando engano se enganou. São dindondão, São Bento, grande homem de movimento, martelo do tribunal, sumiu na mata dentro, foi pego sem documento.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Senate this evening has voted to include a pay raise of more than $30,000 in an overall ethics package on which the senators are still working. By a vote of 65-34, the Senate killed a move by Senator Jesse Helms to strip the pay hike from an ethics bill. Leaders had argued that ethics reforms in the bill would more than offset the political cost of increasing their own salaries. The White House announced today that President Bush has sent a cable to Soviet leader Gorbachev, responding to the one last week from the Soviet president. NPR's Phyllis Crockett has more on the story.
The cable said the president supports the changes in Eastern Europe and the reforms underway in the Soviet Union, that the U.S. wants a calm and peaceful period of change as Poland, Hungary, and East Germany seek to implement their reforms. Those reforms, the president continued, will make a positive contribution to a Europe that is whole and free. The rapid changes in Europe will be among the topics the president discusses with Soviet leader Gorbachev at the Malta summit next month. The president also discussed the summit by phone today with France's President François Mitterrand, Canada's Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, and Chancellor Kohl of West Germany. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
According to Budapest Radio, Romania has sealed its border with reformist Hungary, thus highlighting the country's increasing isolation within Eastern Europe. According to these radio reports, information received so far confirms that nowhere along the Hungarian-Romanian border can the frontier be crossed. In Paris, preparations are underway for a quick summit meeting of the 12 nations that make up the economic community, the free market countries trying to achieve economic unity over the next 3 years. NPR's Alex Chadwick is there, and he filed this report.
The meeting was called by French President François Mitterrand. He and the other heads of state will hold a private dinner in France's presidential palace beginning about 8 tomorrow night. The reason given for the hastily arranged meeting? Developments in East Germany, the symbolic and in places genuine destruction of the Berlin Wall. Analysts say the European community wants to make sure that West Germany's attention remains fixed on the subject of economic unity with the EC partner countries, rather than being tugged away by what is happening in the East. There is also talk of some emergency measures to help the East European countries that are trying to reform their mangled economies. Another EC summit meeting, this one long planned, is scheduled for right after the U.S.-Soviet summit in 2 weeks. This is Alex Chadwick.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up 17 points to close at 2,652.66 on volume of some 151,600,000 shares. Advances led decline 7-6 in only moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brazilian singer, songwriter, and guitarist Caetano Veloso. He's one of the founders of Tropicalismo, a Brazilian musical movement that started in the 60s and brought together the bossa nova, rock, and other musical influences. The music got him imprisoned in the late 60s by the military dictatorship. Several of his records are featured on David Byrne's collection of Brazilian music. Caetano Veloso also has a new record on electromusician called Estrangeiro. He combines traditional Brazilian music with rock and rhythms from around the world. Before we meet him, let's listen to some music from the new album.
Minha música vem da música da poesia de poeta João que não gosta de música. Minha poesia vem da poesia da música de João músico que não gosta de poesia. Minha música vem
saia de um poeta João que não gosta de música.
Veloso also performs solo with his guitar, and that was the case when he visited our studio.
Menino do Rio, calor que provoca arrepio, dragão tatuado no braço, calção, corpo aberto no espaço, coração de eterno flerte, adoro verte, menino vadio, tensão flutuante do rio, eu canto pra Deus proteger-te. O Havaí, seja aqui tudo que sonhares, todos os lugares, as ondas dos mares, pois quando eu te vejo eu desejo teu desejo. Menino do Rio, calor que provoca arrepio, tome esta canção com um beijo. Tome esta canção com um beijo.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
You're from the generation right after Bossa Nova.
Yeah.
If Bossa Nova was jazz and samba, like mixed together, did you bring rock and roll into the equation?
That would be a simpler way of saying it, not, and it's not wrong. But I would say that Bossa Nova was a bit more, or even much more than just jazz and samba. As it was conceived and realized by Antônio Carlos Jobim and João Gilberto, it was a kind of chamber music influenced by cool jazz and by some refined tradition of Brazilian music. So it is samba, basically, and it's a view of samba that's very deep and very refined, too. So then Tropicalismo was the other side of the coin. It was a different thing. It was just using all the trash that Bossa Nova had to put apart in order to be clean and well done.
What do you mean when you say trash?
I mean old romantic kitsch Brazilian songs. I mean international rock and roll, pop, old tangos and fados and Cuban boleros.
How did you start hearing rock and roll in Brazil?
Well, rock and roll since the 50s, as everywhere else, with mostly Elvis and other stuff. But I myself was not very much into rock and roll until the mid-60s when the British, came up with that neo-rock and roll thing, mostly the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. Because before that, I was entirely a Bossa Nova fan and a João Gilberto follower. And also to American jazz, modern, such as Thelonious Monk and the cool phase of Miles Davis and Chet Baker. I used to love Chet Baker.
Well, I can tell because there's this little like parenthetical aside at the beginning of one of your songs on the new record. And it sounds very Chet Baker. You're singing like a little bit of Easy to Love.
Yeah.
On it. It really sounds like a Chet Baker imitation.
Yeah, it must be. It must be.
Were you consciously trying to evoke him when you were doing
Not
that?
Not at that time. I didn't know they were recording that. I was just alone trying the tuning of the guitar and the voice. It was just, I don't know. Then they recorded it. They used it. The producers liked it. Then they used it.
I'm going to just drop that in and play that here.
Okay.
So easy to idolize all others above, so worth the yearning for.
Okay.
So when you started playing music that kind of added to bossa nova, bringing in what you'd describe as all the trash, you're bringing in kitsch and bringing in rock and roll, what was the reaction of the performers of bossa nova and the fans of bossa nova?
Well, the old masters, such as Antonio Carlos Jobim and Carlos Lira, they wouldn't say a word. But some of our colleagues of our same generation, they were prejudiced against it. So were the students, left-wing students in Brazil. They didn't like it because they thought that we were amongst those who were supposed to be respectable and intelligent. So to use rock and roll being used by people like us, that was kind of a shock. And then our generation colleagues reacted against it, so did the left-wing students, who were primarily our normal audience, you know. But then it was kind of a scandal in Brazil.
Before we get to what the government reaction was to your music, is there any way you could play an excerpt of one of the songs that you wrote early on in the mid-60s, one of the songs that caused such controversy?
One of those songs?
Mm-hmm.
Sobre a cabeça os aviões, sobre os meus pés os caminhões, aponta contra os sapatões meu nariz. Eu organizo o movimento, eu oriento o carnaval, eu inauguro o movimento no planalto central do país. Viva a bossa, sa, sa, viva a palhoça, sa, 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 sa. Viva a bossa, sa, sa, viva a palhoça, sa, 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 sa. Something like that. That song was kind of a hymn of tropicalism. It's called Tropicália. And in the recording, there is a string orchestra and horns and electric guitar, all things put together, and Brazilian traditional percussion, northeastern kind of a modal composition. It's a funny combination of strange things.
Caetano Veloso is my guest, and he has a new album called Estrangeiro. We'll take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Brazilian singer, songwriter, and guitarist Caetano Veloso, and his new album is called Estrangeiro. Well, the military dictatorship in Brazil didn't take well to your music. You were, in fact, arrested.
Yes.
What did the government find that threatening about the music that you were playing?
I don't know. Maybe they didn't understand. They just understood as much as the left-wing students did, or even less. They were afraid because they thought it was anarchical in a way. The words were kind of, they had some violence in its poetry. And the music was confusing because we were putting together different things. Plus, our behavior on television and on stage was new in many aspects. We had, some of us had long hairs, we would wear African clothes. It was a bit frightening, and it was kind of a scandal in Brazil. And a bad coincidence happened. So in 1968, we started being famous with that thing in 1967. And in 1968, they had this coup d'etat within the coup d'etat. So they moved even more to the right side. And so it was a coincidence that we had just became famous with a new thing that was difficult to understand, that was somehow violent, that changed behavior, could influence the youth. So they got afraid. They decided to put us in prison.
When you were in prison, were there many other artists and performers in prison too?
There were lots of journalists, professors, teachers, some other intellectuals, writers, but from the pop scene, some film directors too, but from the pop music scene, only Gilberto Gil and me, one of the two Tropicalistas.
Were there any guards there who actually turned out to be fans of yours?
Yeah.
And how did they respond to you?
I remember that once when I was first allowed to have a walk in the sun after some 4 or 5 days of being in there, this very young guy was with a machine gun pointed to my back while I was walking around in the sun, you know, and he would say, "Caetano, I'm so sorry that I'm doing this," with the machine gun pointed to my back. But he said, "Please don't do any strange movement because I'm supposed to shoot you. That's crazy. It's unbelievable." He was very sorry. Some were really, they didn't like to be in that situation either. But some were tough. Some were not friendly.
When you got out of prison, you were basically told to leave the country?
Well, when we left the prison, we were home arrested in Bahia for 4 months after the 2 months in prison. And we couldn't work, nor give interviews, nothing. And in the end, they invited us to leave the country. And they arranged everything so that in four days' time, they had all our papers prepared for us to leave the country. They put us in the plane. The police themselves, they put us in a plane, and they said, "Don't come back." Then we went to Europe. Then we lived in London.
When and why did you decide to return home to Brazil?
I decided to return home always, immediately. As soon as I was there, the only thing I wanted was to go back to Brazil. The only thing was the government wouldn't allow us to go back. Until they didn't allow, I stayed in London. As soon as they allowed us, I went back immediately.
Now, how had the music changed when you went back? And did you feel like you were out of what was happening in Brazil when you got back there?
No, not really, because we were in touch with Brazilian friends, and we got all the important and interesting records. We were talking to everybody, knowing everything, reading newspapers and magazines, writing letters, talking on the telephone, doing everything. So I knew everything that was going on in Brazil. But anyway, it's different to be abroad, because coming back, you listen to radio, you are there. I mean, it's different. But the thing that changed the most was that while we were in prison, in confinement, then in exile, all the left-wing students who didn't like the stuff we were doing before tried to make us into heroes, you know. And it was very funny because they expect us to be kind of leaders, political leaders or something. So that kind of political idol that they thought that we could be. But that died in 3 days because I arrived and I had this concert. I sang everything that I wanted to sing. And I did exactly what I wanted to do. And it was kind of a disappointment to lots of people because I wouldn't fit in.
So do you think of your music as standing for anything politically or culturally now beyond good music?
I don't know. I don't like the idea of thinking that everything is political, because some things must not be political. I learned that. But more important than that, the political situation and the social situation will be there wherever I'm conscious of it or not, you know. So I always try to be as conscious as I can of what kind of weight a song, a singing, a show, a record could have in a society.
The title song of your new record is called The Stranger. Of course, it's called that,
that
in Portuguese.
That means foreigner. That means foreigner.
Oh, okay.
As well. Mostly foreigner.
Ah, okay. I was wondering if you had felt like a stranger even in your own home now. But I can ask you if you feel like a foreigner even in your own home now because you've spent time outside of it.
Yeah, yeah. It's also, although it's a very, I love that song, that long song, but it's also a joke to have that title because the record was made here in New York with some American friends who produced it for me, with me. And so it was going to be a foreigner here and a foreigner there. So it has that connotation too, which is the light one.
Well, that leads me to wondering if in America you're seen as like authentic Brazilian music, and if in Brazil you're seen as having a lot of American influence, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if really here I have these, among people who know me or who know my music, the few people who got to know my music, if among these people I am seen as being an authentic Brazilian musician, I'm not sure of that, really. Some people think that it's strange to have these things mixed, even here. And some think that in this record, this is happening for the first time. But it's a joke. It's very funny to think that, because that was our main thing when we just started working in Brazil back in 1965, 66. So it's always been like this.
Brazilian singer-songwriter and guitarist Caetano Veloso. He has a new record on electro musician called Estrangeiro.
Some may like a soft Brazilian singer, but I've given up all attempts at perfection.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're working on at All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi there, Terry. We are continuing to watch the war in El Salvador. We will talk about the state of affairs right now today and also take a look at some of the historical perspective and about American aid programs to that country. From Berlin, Robert Siegel reports on a skilled labor shortage in East Germany, and Mike Schuster will have more on the reforms of the new government of Hans Modrow. Noah Adams is out west, and today he rides in the front with the engineer on the train from Wenatchee, Apple Country in Washington to the end of the line, Seattle.
Thanks, Linda. That and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My Left Foot is a new movie based on the autobiography of the Irish writer and artist Christy Brown. He died from choking in 1981 at the age of 49. Critic at large Laurie Stone says the film is a moving testament to a passionate life.
My Left Foot is that rare, delightful accomplishment, a movie that transports you completely to another world. Here, it's the inner life of Christy Brown, an Irish writer and painter who became an artist against all odds. He was born with severe cerebral palsy and was considered little more than a vegetable by the doctors who first treated him. Films about the disabled are mostly sentimental and simplistic, not this one. My Left Foot is a stunning depiction of repression and of the ways the erotic life and the desire for independence whelm up, no matter what. Christy could not walk or speak, though he could make garbled sounds. The only part of his body he could control was his left foot with its powerful big toe. Eventually, he learned to grip a piece of chalk and painstakingly write the word mother on the floor. That day, he amazed his family and left no doubts about the intelligence and will locked inside him. He taught himself to use his big toe to type and paint, and he learned to speak haltingly but intelligibly with the help of an enlightened doctor. My Left Foot was written and directed by Jim Sheridan, who never made a movie before, but who has crafted a work of exceptional coherence and directness in a series of quick, pointed scenes. We see Christy cringing in fear and rage as his drunken father terrorizes the family. At other moments, he exults because he's included in the outdoor games devised by the neighborhood kids. As he gets older, he drinks hard, his speech bristles with irony, and he misses no opportunity to flirt and assert his sexual needs. Daniel Day-Lewis, who plays Christy, gives an astoundingly naked performance, and by holding back nothing, he offers the fullest tribute to the figure he portrays, a man who was physically unable to veil his impulses and appetites. Day-Lewis is turning into the supreme chameleon of his generation. He's hardly recognizable from part to part, whether playing the prissy character in A Room with a View or the passionate punky gay man in Beautiful Laundrette. Here, with his mouth clenched, his neck swaying, and his eyes burning, he is all pent-up energy, seeking any available avenue to explode. And when he does, either in artistic expression or when drunk in fits of rage, he generates catharsis after catharsis for the viewer. People at the screening I attended, myself included, kept crying and heaving and emoting, not because the movie was trying to wring these emotions. To the contrary, we were venting for Christy. It was a way of coping with the spectacle of so much frustration. Christy is constrained by his claustrophobic family life, his bullying father, his muscles. When he learns to write, he is speaking not only for himself, but for his sisters and mother, who suffer abuse stoically and live as hostages to the family patriarch's moods. Christy is vindictively victorious when he sells his book to a publisher and earns more than his father ever did in a year. My Left Foot is so honest, and Day-Lewis's acting is such a marvel, the movie is joyously entertaining even when it's painful. We see a man inhibited by outward circumstances, but who himself never represses his hunger and passion. It's fascinating to see these yearnings flow unstintingly.
Lori Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. My Left Foot is currently playing in New York and Los Angeles. It opens in more cities next month. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the music reviews and commentaries. It's all edited and mixed by Roberta Sharrock and Joan Tuohy. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the husband and wife rhythm section, Chris Franz and Tina Weymouth. They co-founded the band Talking Heads and lead the group Tom Tom Club. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews highlights of this year's New Music America Festival. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.